winning Newcastle. I am Jojo James, the chair of this interview panel. I'm also the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. Welcome to this interview. Relax. Don't feel threatened by us. We are honorable members. We are not horrible people. We will ask questions because interviews are about questions. So relax, feel free. If you feel like drinking water at any given point in time during the interview, you are allowed to do so. Can you please now switch off? I think the honorable members also must do that so that we are not distracted by cell phone. Ms. Keswa, can you please introduce yourself by telling this interview panel about your background and experience, and why do you want to be a commissioner for the Public Service Commission?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning, Honorable Members of the panel. Thank you for the opportunity that you've given me to come and present myself to yourselves. When I was preparing my application and looking at the number of years that I've worked in the public service and the things that I've achieved, I realized how long I've been in the public service. When I retired in 2013, I had a 30 years plus of public service work, 18 years of which I worked in the Public Service Commission. I started as a human resource officer, and I grew up in the ranks until in 1996. I was an acting head of department in the Provincial Service Commission in the Eastern Cape. At that time, that's when the commission, each province had its own commission in terms of the interim constitution before there was a single public service commission. And I think, if I remember well, I was the last HOD of that Provincial Service Commission as it was structured there. Why do I want to be a commissioner? Chairperson, I think I still have in me an ability to contribute as I contributed before. And I think I still have in me more that I could share and contribute to the public service. And that is why I thought I should apply.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Keswa. What is your understanding of the values and principles enshrined in Section 195 of the Constitution? You can tell us that by mentioning few, and elaborate where you feel you want to elaborate.
Thank you, Chair. Section 195 of the Constitution prescribes the kind of values and principles the public service should live on in the manner in which they render public service. One is the high standards of professional ethics. That would be the high values relating to fighting corruption, exercising one's power and one's functional responsibilities with integrity and honesty. That's what I consider professional ethics to encompass. The second one is the efficient, economic and effective use of public resources. I know that public officials can be effective in what they do with less resources, if they are conscious of efficient use of the resources. But you do find instances where the same service could be rendered at the most exorbitant. I mean, the news in the newspapers and on television are replete with cases where public resources were not used efficiently. The other principle value is that of transparency and accountability. You know, if public servants were transparent in the manner they do things, people would know what they should expect and why it is that the standard that they can expect from public servants. If they knew, probably there would be less service delivery protests than they are at the moment. But people go on protests because they do not know. There's too much expectation. They do not know how much to expect because public servants are not transparent. They are not giving accurate information. And the other one is that the public servants should be responsive to the needs of the people. I don't know how many times we've heard and read about the public seeking services, particularly those services where they cannot go and buy them in the private sector, where they are rendered only by the public service, how sometimes public servants are not responsive. The other one is a development-oriented public service. That to me says even for people in higher authority within the public services, their orientation in the manner in which they manage human resources should have a development orientation or development focus, whilst the services they render to the public also should have that development focus.
Can you briefly tell us what is your understanding of the functions of the Public Service Commission?
Thank you, Chair. In terms of Section 196 of the Constitution, as well as the Public Service Commission Act. The Public Service Commission is charged with promoting the values and principles that we talked about that are prescribed in Section 25 throughout the public service. The Public Service Commission also is tasked with investigating, monitoring, and evaluating human resource practices within the public service to ensure that they live the values and the principles enshrined in the Constitution. The Public Service Commission must also give direction where human resource practices are not compliant, if you wish, with the values and principles that are enshrined in the Constitution for public administration. And it also assists with the organization and establishment and evaluates how the public services are structured and organized. The Public Service Commission also must, on its own accord, or when they receive a complaint, they must investigate complaints that relate to how personal practices are rendered. And if there's a specific complaint about omissions or commissions by officials, then the PSC must investigate and report to the relevant executing authority and the legislature, whichever is the appropriate, whether it's a provincial legislature or a national legislature, depending on where the investigation was done. And they must recommend a remedial action. And first, promote transparency, accountability, and responsiveness of the public service.
Thank you, Ms. Kesso. The honorable members of this panel are as well going to ask you questions, and they are going to introduce themselves as they ask questions. I'm therefore now calling on Honorable Lesoma.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My name is Lesoma, member of the committee. Welcome, Ms. Kesso, and also appreciate your interest to serve the country. I will be asking a question, but my approach will have a statement or a preamble than the question. I'm sure that you do have a writing pad before you so that you can. If you don't, although you want me to repeat, I will gladly do so, through the chair, of course. When you were introducing yourself, also you made a reference to the NA Constitution of 1996 and also the Public Service Act. Kindly then, making a preamble, the Constitution then, in particular, makes us provide for a much stronger role of the Public Service Commission, as it were, in upholding the principles of public administration, which we have outlined already. One of its functions is to give a direction aimed at ensuring that personal procedures relating to recruitment, transfer, promotion, and dismissal comply with the values and principles of the public administration. Then the question, what can be the best strategy in assisting the Public Service Commission to ensure that government departments appoint competent individuals, men and women, and dedicated public servants, particularly at the senior management level. I will stop there, then I'll come to the second question. If you may respond, Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I think the best strategy would be, if you allow me to be controversial, would be less cater deployment without evaluation. I qualify that without evaluation. I have had the experience where sometimes the appointment at senior levels in the public service is not done, doesn't go through a rigorous process of assessment. Because once you bring a senior official to an organ of state who doesn't have the requisites of the position, one, you are setting up the person to fail. Two, the people he or she gets to manage will undermine him or her and can even sabotage his efforts because they know better than him or her. So for me, I would say rigorous assessment of the capabilities of the people who are employed at senior levels is key, without which it can't work. That's one. Two, even when people with requisite educational qualifications, training, experience are employed, continuous personal development is also key, because as the systems develop and new technologies are acquired, there are new ways of doing things, better ways of doing things. And if people do not go through personal development and training, they tend to stagnate where they were and not grow and not acquire new skills. So for me, those are the two. Acquire the best that you can to come and work, and then continuously develop them. I want to believe that that would be the best.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thanks, Ms. Kessel. For me, this one will be my last question, where the same approach is one. The National Development Plan made an emphasis that South Africa needs to build a state that is capable of applying a developmental, which you alluded to earlier on, responding to the Chairperson's question, and transformative role. Playing a developmental and a transformative role. A sub-question on that will say, what are the challenges that hinder public administration in potentially realizing a developmental state in your own understanding way? Two, what sort of public service is required by South Africa to achieve its developmental objectives? Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you.
think that what hinders the state amongst other things, I wouldn't give an exhaustive list, but I think amongst other things would be that if there is no sync between what the state seeks to achieve and the hands and feet that it has to achieve that. If there is no sync between the people who work for the state and understanding and appreciating what the state seeks to achieve, then the state could come up with good policies and directions, but then the implementing agents who are supposed to pursue that agenda are not in sync, are not thinking in the same way as the leadership, if you wish. So the first thing would be, after determining what would be a developmental trajectory that the state wants to pursue, then that must be translated into what tangible outcomes are expected from people who must pursue that trajectory. If there is, it would then flow from the broad plans that the state has put across into the state departments as implementing agents in terms of their own plans, and then from there into the individual people who are working within the state to create that synchronization. And thereafter have a measure of, determine a measure as to how you're going to be able to monitor and evaluate how people are performing towards that developmental agenda. Can you repeat the second question then, just?
Through me and Ms. Castle. Honorable Usama, can you repeat the second question?
You don't outsource the power. Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thanks, Ms. Castle. I'll gladly repeat the question. It's a next question following from what I asked earlier. What sort of public service is required by South Africa to achieve this developmental objective? I will request, Chair, that also you don't repeat what you have said, because you are partially responding to this question. And probably I might as well make a follow-up quickly so that I don't come back. What is your understanding of the state? Because you have been repeating it. And I just want your appreciation. What constitutes the state? Thank you, Chair.
The development.
No, Chair, the state, because in her response, she didn't, also she separated developmental state and state
and
when she
state,
was responding.
Okay,
so I'm just picking up what you said in terms of the state.
Right.
You are understanding what it constitutes state. Thank
okay.
you, Chair.
Thank you.
My understanding of the state is all arms of the state working together. The legislative arm of the state supporting the executive arm of the state, because what the legislature puts across as policy and legislative direction, the implementing agent, is the executive. So developmental, and as well as the judiciary being the arbiter of executive, how executive authority and how legislative authority is exercised. Development-oriented state would be the type, starting with the type of legislation that is put across that promotes development. The executive that is also attuned towards development. But you do have a state that is more, for a lack of a better word, that is more maintaining the status quo. That is why I speak of development state, development a state and a state. Because you can find a state that is seeking to maintain the status quo for different reasons, one of which is to appease certain portions of society. But a development state is the one that recognizes where we come from. It's a state that acknowledges and makes no apology about the fact that there are certain sectors of society who come from a disadvantage. And therefore, in the manner in which it develops policy, the manner in which it develops legislation would be to acknowledge that and be able to pursue those who come from disadvantage should also be pulled through, and that happens through equitable resource allocation, such that you don't perpetuate what has been.
Honorable Sibis.
Morning, Chairperson. We welcome you, Ms. Kaswa. I am Honorable Sibisi, a member of the Portfolio Committee. I'll be checking you on good governance. So I'll also give you a statement about the good governance. Effective governance in the public sector encourages better decision making and the efficient use of resources. So my question to you would be, how could you define good governance? That is the first question. And then the second question would be, what are the five main principles of good governance within the context of a democratic government and efficient public service? Thank you.
Can you repeat the first question? You want me to define good governance?
Ask him through me, Professor. I'm a chairperson that is so jealous about his power. Okay.
Okay. Answer that
question there. Thank you, Chairperson. The first, to repeat the what the
yes
the first.
I'll also start from the statement again.
No, not the statement.
Oh, you are fine. The question would be, how could you define good governance? That is question one. You are fine with question two. Okay, that's it.
Good governance is about ethical leadership, is about ethical rendition of services. It revolves around people appreciating the resources that they are using where they come from. That the resources they are spending are ordinary John and Jane citizens' tax. Therefore, whatever they do, it's an attitude. Whatever they do is based on doing the most with the least. Spending as less as possible, but achieving what you intended to achieve. You can only achieve that if one, your integrity as a human being, that what you have been assigned is for greater good. What you've been assigned is not for personal enrichment. If you have resources given to you, they are for the public, not for yourself. If good governance says, what I do is not for my enrichment or the enrichment of those close to me, the principles then would be efficiency in what you do, integrity in how you carry yourself, honesty, transparency. Openness and transparency to me is key, because if you are open and transparent in the manner in which you do things, people will question you. If you are going to acquire services and the rents and cents you spend do not tally, for the lack of a better word, with what you seek to achieve, then people are going to question you why you are doing that. And the minute you are not transparent, you are not open, then you can do all shenanigans that because nobody is going to question you because people don't know. So to me, one of the principles that is key to good governance is openness and transparency, as well as accountability. And consulting people. I was listening yesterday to the news. Not that I'm suggesting that is not part of good governance, but I was thinking about that now that I'm talking about a consultation. That the Department of Minerals is seeking to build a monument in Mpumalanga, where there was a mine disaster and three people died and were never retrieved. And I was thinking to myself, and the families are up in arms about that, they are unhappy, and I'm thinking to myself, this is a good gesture if only people were consulted. Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Dr. Schreiber.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, Ms. Kessler. My question relates to the perennial issue of corruption. Specifically, one form of corruption that has persisted is public servants doing business with the state. So I'd like us to focus on that specific issue for a moment. As you know, there is already legislation in place, I believe dating from 2014, that prohibits this from happening, and yet it is something that's ongoing. We've even received reports in this committee of this practice continuing. So if we look at this practical, specific example, what would you say is the best way from making sure that this law is actually implemented and that we practically see the elimination of this kind of behavior where public servants do business with the state. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. There is already a requirement that I think is at the level of senior management that there's a declaration of business interest. But I want to propose that perhaps that should permeate the entire public service. And if there is also, today technology is so advanced that you could have a system in the procurement, within the procurement processes, you could have a system where a tender process is registered and tenderers are registered as well. Then, if there is a name that raises red flags, then a red flag could be triggered. And then an investigation can go through to check why is there a red flag. If there could be a system like that, but first of all, a policy direction which says this does not end only at the level of senior management, but permeates right through, because it's not only senior managers who are doing business with the state. And in that way, immediately there is a tenderer who has similarities in terms of either ID or a name or a location, whatever would be the factors that are looked at. It would trigger an inquiry that can then be pursued to check how is the red flag coming up. I think perhaps there would be an enforcement, because probably it's an enforcement, one of the issues now. It's an enforcement that is not there.
Someone want to follow up?
To be consistent with the
okay,
all right,
you are granted.
Ms. Kesso, I've declared myself that I'm trying my level best to be consistent in terms of the question. Follow up from Honorable Doc's question is to say, what is your view or your take in respect of, there's a perception that senior management seems not to be, they are shying away from being vetted. What is your take on that? But in relation to the question that has been asked. Thank you so much, Chair.
Chair, may I ask, is the vetting that the Honourable Member referring to vetting in terms of security or vetting broadly in terms of business interest?
Through your with the latter part of it, broadly as possible, so that because that's why I'm linking it with the principal question from Dr. Honorable Member. Thank you.
Chair, I don't know why would people not be keen to be vetted with. Because if from the very beginning of your engagement as a civil servant, whatever the level is, you commit yourself to live by the constitutional values in terms of Section 195. I do not see why then you would not give a blanket check to government to say, go wherever you want to go and find whatever you want to find about them. To me, the minute you say there are certain parts of you that must not be seen, that immediately raises red flags to say, what is it that you don't want us to see? It then questions your integrity. Because if you are If you have nothing to fear, you give authority. You want to check my bank account, you want to check how much overdraft I have. Feel free. I everything that I have, I've worked for. And I have credit cards owing, I have overdraft, everything. You're interested in that, fine, go and have a look. I don't, because if you are a person of integrity, you want to present yourself that there's nothing else. You're seeing that this is me. You're seeing there's nothing more that I'm hiding that you will not be able to see. I don't understand why people would not want to be that picture.
Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning, MM Kesa. I'm Miriam Kibi, a member of the committee and also a member of the panel. I'll be asking you two questions. My first one is on strengthening oversight. How do you think the BSC can strengthen its own oversight and oversight by Parliament? I think you can respond to that one, and later I'll ask you the second one.
Chair, the Public Service Commission, in my view, has a very critical role to play in overseeing public administration. The difficulty, though, which was not there when the interim constitution was operational, is that the Public Service Commission does not have teeth. The Public Service Commission, yes, has a directive role. It can give direction in certain areas, but in most areas, it gives advice, it recommends, like in the instance, for instance, of when there is a grievance, it will recommend remedial action. Yes, the executing authority must comply within a specific period, but then what if there is no compliance? What if whatever it is that the commission has said, this does not comply with the values of the constitutional values and principles, what then? What can it do? So I am saying the way of strengthening oversight by the Public Service Commission would be to consider giving it teeth through a legislative process. How can Parliament exercise oversight over the Public Service Commission? It's, in my view, requiring reporting, rigorous reporting, and not just reporting, but interrogation by the committee of the performance, how it has performed, and having worked in Parliament for 13 years at HOD level, there were times where we looked at how committees sometimes exercise oversight, and we think, oh, this is sweetheart oversight. So if oversight were not to be sweetheart oversight, would be real oversight, would then jack up the commission to be saying, we can't go to Parliament and present a report that's wishy-washy like that. And a wishy-washy report would be coming from a wishy-washy oversight that they had exercised. But if they had exercised, if the commission had exercised rigorous oversight of the public service, they would be reporting to yourselves on tangible issues that they pick up. So there is a dual feeder, if you wish, in that the committee, when it's conducting oversight over the Public Service Commission, would be forcing the Public Service Commission to be just as rigorous in the own oversight of the public service. I don't know if that answers your question. Thank you,
Madam Chairman. My second question, therefore, will start with the preamble. During the State of Nation Address, President outlined 7 priorities for the 6th administration. Among it is to build capable, ethical, and developmental state, which is what Chapter 10 of the Constitution envisaged. Now my question is, what role should the BSC play in ensuring realization of building capable, ethical, and a developmental state?
This is a huge responsibility for the Public Service Commission, in my view, because, as I said, if the Public Service Commission does not exercise its oversight responsibility in a rigorous manner, it will not assist in building the ethical state. The Public Service Commission has a responsibility in terms of its functions to evaluate how public services are rendered and whether they are in sync with the values and principles enshrined in Section 195. If the Public Service Commission does not perform that particular function, monitoring evaluation of the public services, then what the President said of building a capable and ethical development state will remain a pipe dream. I think the PSC is at the center of realizing that, because if it exercises its functions and it exercises its oversight role over the public service, it's the only way, in my view, because it's at the center of that.
Thank you, Honorable Sir.
Thank you.
Honorable Toli.
Good morning, Ms. Kessa. Thank you for taking the public service very serious to even come for the interviews. And also one of that wound from you. I thought you are part of the parliament. This morning I was standing outside and you greeted me. Now I saw you here. Oh, he was coming for the interview. Well, Ms. Kessa, my question.
Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Makoni Ntuli, Member of Parliament and member of this subcommittee. My question is going to be around the finances. Can I give you the background? My background is the financial disclosure framework is aimed at preventing conflicts of interest by requiring members of the senior management service to disclose
their financial interest. Then my question is, provide an explanation on how the financial disclosure works. Thank you.
If I understand your question well, ma'am, I would respond by, I think it's more related to the question that I answered a little earlier relating to good governance and corruption, prevention of corruption. Senior managers, because the bank stops with them, they are expected in terms of the financial disclosure framework to indicate their business interests, as well as if they want to perform remunerative work outside of the public service, they have to be authorized. The reason is to limit or minimize conflicts of interest between their responsibilities within the public service and their personal interests. But, you know, we know that that does not happen often, or it does not happen honestly. Because I can decide that, okay, my business interest, I'm not going to register it in my name. I'm going to register it in my cousin's name or in my son's name or whoever else in my family to hide that I have a business interest. It's unfortunate that human nature does things like those. But as I indicated earlier, if you had a system that is able to pick on certain cues and raise red flags, then questions like these could be answered. But basically what the framework requires is that I must declare, this is what I used to do in Parliament yearly. At a certain time I was required to complete the form and declare and tell Parliament how where my business interests are, if I earn money outside of Parliament, and if I have properties that I rent out, and if I rent them out, to who do I rent them out, those kinds of things. But it is, as I said, human nature. I could hide certain information which I know is going to trap me. I could hide that. But it's important that somebody somewhere within the public service is tasked with tracking things like those. Who discloses and who doesn't? And those who do not disclose, the reasons for not disclosing, because it's reported, I suppose, even in Parliament, members' interests also are reported. There are reports that some members don't disclose, so it happens in the public service as well that some senior members do not disclose. And there must be consequences, which is sometimes which I think is what puts the public service at risk, is consequence management. What happens when people do certain things that are either against the law or against policy? What happens? And sometimes people are not made to face the consequences. My background is more a conflict manager, and as a result, I am hesitant to take punitive action when people do things. I am more a corrective person first before you bring a stick. But it's important that people should know. If a carrot does not work, then a stick will work. I think that's how this area of disclosures of business interests could be managed, is where there is consequences, and those consequences are dire for people if they don't do it and they are enforced.
Ms. Kessler, I will preface my question with a preamble. The power to appoint in South Africa is assigned by Section 3, Subsection 7 of the Public Service Act. Ministers or MECs can delegate the power to officials within the department. What are the major obstacles in the recruitment system in the public sector? Is the public sector recruitment system effective in order to ensure professional and capable state? That's the first part of my question. You can answer the first part.
What are the obstacles to recruiting? Okay. I think, Chair, there is a saying, I don't know whether it's, there is a saying that says we are targeting to employ a particular group of people because we want to be broadly representative of the South African society, but we cannot find the target group. It may well be true that it is so because of the disadvantage that people come from. Now, if you can't recruit the target group you're looking for, it means you're not actively seeking to develop people at the level you want them to be. So obstacles would be, one, the absence of the group you're targeting to make your public service representative. It may well be that. But then, what measures do you put in place to ensure that you do develop the group you are targeting to the level at which you're looking for? That's the first one. The second obstacle is even when you have capable people of the group you are targeting, but if your orientation as the person who is recruiting, if your own orientation is such that you're not confident, you're not confident of that you can get the better people from a certain sector, then you are likely to pass the people who are capable. I don't know if I'm putting myself across, but maybe I would give an example. And I would make a due apology to the members. There was a time here in Parliament where at the level, senior level, Parliament was saying, we cannot find black females who can take positions at senior level. And we thought we were going to prove that that argument was fallacious, that in actual fact Parliament was targeting a particular man for certain positions at higher level. And I've got personal experience that people present obstacles when they are not. So, in short, Chairperson, the obstacles would be, one, where you are not able to find the capable people in the target group, or when your attitude and your own orientation is not open to seeking and looking for capable people from the target group. Thirdly, the type of assessment you use to evaluate people's capability. When I was a human resource officer way back in 1982 or so in the Public Service Commission, we used to have a battery of tests, psychological tests, that we used to put people through. And those batteries of tests, arguments against using them was how culture fair and culture balanced, the biased they were. So all of the evaluation tools you have to assess the type of people you're looking for, what type of tools are they? Are they designed to give you a particular group of people who come from a particular race group or from a particular class? So those would be your obstacles in getting the people.
Is the public sector recruitment system effective in order to ensure professional and capable state?
I want to believe that it can be effective if it's applied properly. I think it is. If you remove personal interest, if the people behind the assessment tool are people of integrity who are looking for the right people, I want to believe that the public service can get the people, the right people that it's looking for.
What can be the role of the Public Service Commission in eliminating unethical practices in the recruitment system in order to ensure public servants are appointed based on merit?
It's a difficult one because, as I indicated, that it depends on who's sitting on the other side of the evaluation tool, whatever the tool is that's being used. It's a difficult one because human elements get into it. But I think the Public Service Commission would be, they could assess and evaluate the tools that are being used, that are being used to assess. That's one. And also perhaps the Public Service Commission, particularly at senior level, could perhaps play a much more bigger role in the evaluation process. I know that the Public Service Act, the Public Service Commission Act, as well as the Constitution, they give the mandate to the public service, a different mandate to the Public Service Commission than it used to have. I think perhaps if a certain element of the role that the Public Service Commission used to have in the recruitment processes, where it could have an opportunity of also evaluating, after all the screening had been undertaken, perhaps at departmental level, perhaps the Public Service Commission could also, at senior level that is, could also have an endorsement, if you wish, of their own assessment of the candidates that are being put there. Theft have a tool. Mm-hmm. That can be adopted throughout, and then perhaps amend their role to involve them at the final stages of the assessment, particularly at higher level like HOD. But at this point, obviously, in terms of the law, it's not. The PSC doesn't have that role, but that's my thinking.
Ms. Kaswai, is there any question you would like to put, or you want to make a follow-up? Okay. Thank you, Honorable Swain.
Thanks, Chair. So just on this proposal, because I think it's probably something this committee will eventually apply its mind to as well. So for our benefit, where does, I recorded your earlier statement about, I think you said, cadre deployment without evaluation was the phrase you used. Do you see the involvement of politicians in that process that you are just thinking about here as appropriate and ethical, or is it something that must be left entirely to the department and the PSC?
That's a difficult one, Chair, to say politicians should not be involved. For the simple reason that I think in most, even in advanced democracies, a party in power would want to be assured that the people it has placed in senior positions would be people who would pursue what they want to achieve. I think there would be comfort in the leadership of the party that's in government, that they have people who are in their positions. Therefore, I'm not suggesting that there shouldn't be cadre development. I'm not suggesting that. But I am saying the cadres that a governing party wants to deploy must go through. It may well be that the assessment would first be at the level of the political party, and they'd be comfortable that this cadre knows what is or has the capabilities of what is required in a particular position. But then, from that deployment, then it goes to another level of assessment, which now does not involve the politician, which would be the technical assessment as well as the PSC to confirm whether what the government party wants to, the person who the government party wants to deploy is indeed capable of doing what is required. I would be naive if I would say politicians should not be involved, because they want to be assured that the person who is at the top there is somebody who will not sabotage us as a government party. I mean, that's how in most democracies, that's how it works.
Not really, not to put you on the spot, it's just it's an interesting and difficult question. My sense in response to that is the trust that you're talking about. So the question is about whether the politician has trust in the officials. But shouldn't the trust be a function precisely of a body like the PSC, which is there to appoint people who are implementing policy, and their only job is to implement policy. If the politician says it's policy A, then the PSC assures that the people who are implementing it, the officials, will implement policy A regardless of any kind of political feelings they have about it. So I think that's probably the other way to look at it, to say that the politicians are the policy makers and they must have free rein to make whatever policy they want. But when it comes to implementing policy, if there is a body like the PSC or whatever it happens to be in a particular case that actually makes sure that whoever is the official will implement the policy with no question of sabotage or whatever, creating that kind of bureaucracy, then there are also many examples of countries who have gone that route. And it is just an interesting way of trying to tackle this question. So I just wanted to put it out there. But for all of our benefit to see all the angles here. Thank you, Jeff.
I think she has sufficiently answered the question you put and qualified it that throughout democracies, no political party that is governing would not select who must be put in a position. But that selection by a political party must also be accompanied by requisite skills of this incumbent. I think she has answered it very nicely. Yeah, that's enough. Yeah.
You want to follow up?
I wanted to follow up in a comment form to say I've been consistent, Chairperson, in asking this question, and apparently Ms. Kessa covered me in two folds. She mentioned that politicians should, however, do any political career development through evaluation. But I was wondering whether she's going to cover it in terms of the PSC as to what role can be played by the PSC to eliminate such. But because I've been consistent in asking this question throughout the interviews, I'm covered. Thank you.
She has answered that question. Mm-hmm. Yes, she has. I don't want to put her on the spot again because I listened carefully when she was answering, and she has covered the question you are answering. I mean, you are asking. Yeah. Okay. Is there any question you would like to put to this, I mean, or comment to the committee?
Question or comment? You are not compelled. You are not compelled.
We are just want to be fair. Yeah.
Sometimes, Chair, when you are given an opportunity like that to ask a question like that, you think to yourself, I wish I could ask this question. But on the other hand, you're thinking, how is it going to be received? If I may ask about this process, Chair, would you be in a position to indicate perhaps when you are likely to complete the process? It's just for my own also personal planning, just to know if this is finished and I'm successful, these are the likely scenarios, and if I'm not successful, well, that's fine. I just want to get a sense if there is a way of knowing that.
I was going to address that at the end.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, to say we still have some applicants or candidates that we must interview, but this process will be completed fairly soon within this term. And then you will be informed in writing about the outcome of your interview. And I therefore want to thank you very much, Ms. Kessler. Thank you for unveiling yourself here. You are therefore here.
Thank you, Honourable Member.